IATSE891 presents Apple Box Talks, the podcast where we get to talk to the very best artists, technicians, and interest holders that make up the BC entertainment industry. From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes. Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Crystal.
And I'm Hillary. We're joined via Zoom today by the Executive Director of the Disability Screen Office, Winnie Luck.
Officially announced in April 2022, the Disability Screen Office was launched through a collaborative effort led by Accessible Media Inc. and with funding from Telefilm Canada and the Canadian Media Fund. Winnie Luck was appointed in June 2023 as the DSO's inaugural Executive Director. She is an advocate and an activist, and her lived experience with mobility issues has fueled her passion for advocating for accessibility rights. Winnie was featured last year in our Kinetoscope magazine, and we are so glad to have her joining us on the Apple Box today. Welcome, Winnie.
Thank you so much for having me.
So talk to us about the Disability Screen Office. What is its role? What is its mission? And how did you come to be involved?
The Disability Screen Office is a national, disability-led, not-for-profit organization that develops opportunities for disabled creatives and advocates for a more accessible Canadian screen industry. We are, in Canada, very behind in this work, especially in this sector. We are behind the UK, Australia, and the States in this work in regards to funding, programs, and resources. And our vision at the DSO is essentially is an accessible and inclusive Canadian screen industry where disabled creatives can thrive. And so we really aim to do this by building relationships and fostering connections among our disabled creatives and working with them, influencing those working already in the industry at every stage of content production, making sure we're removing barriers and creating opportunities again for disabled creatives, advocating for policies that support disabled creatives in the screen industry, and ensuring that the long-term success of our office is obviously important for disabled creatives to engage and partake and really thrive in this sector.
So tell us what that looks like from a film technician's point of view, because this industry really isn't that accessible, right? I mean, we're on mountaintops, we're in locations that are actually physically difficult for anybody to get in and out of, just from a physical point of view. And then other factors like the work hours and all of the things that happen for film technicians. So what does that look like on a practical set? And are there things our members can do to foster a more inclusive environment?
I think probably the number one question that folks should be asking, especially their team, when they're hiring, when they're building their project and their team, you should be asking each other and during interviews are, what are your access needs? Right? What are the folks, the people that you're wanting to work with, communication styles, access needs? Everyone really have different communication styles, whether you're disabled or not. And when we're doing this work, it's really about being proactive, planning, making sure that we're being preventative in a lot of natures. So again, setting expectations. So with the accessibility and disability lens, when you're talking about sets, when you're talking about venues, locations, what have you, it is about making sure that when we're thinking about the work and the project, we ask ourselves, is this accessible to all, right? We're talking about universal design. And even within disability, there are so many different types of disabilities, right? We talk about the physical, whether someone is using a mobility device, whether it's a wheelchair or a walking aid or a cane, et cetera. But there are folks who are blind and low vision, who maybe are deaf, who are neurodivergent, have intellectual disabilities. There are so many disabilities and varying degrees of disability as well that you cannot just assume. So the best way forward is asking those questions, asking for people's access needs right off the top. And again, this is beneficial for everyone, not just for folks who are disabled. And what do folks need in the sense of communication style, expectation, work culture for them to thrive in their role. And so it is really about making sure that everyone's aligned on this and doing it proactively, planning this, especially in your budgeting, right? So accommodations, some don't cost anything. It's really more about prioritizing, but there are things that have hard costs to it. So you want to make sure that you're budgeting appropriately and have an accessibility budget line, so you're not reacting, you know, however many months down the line when you're doing the hiring, that you're actually discriminating against someone because you cannot provide them with their access or accommodation needs that they need to thrive. And so it's really about having the accessibility lens, doing it upfront, asking those important questions, and I would even add sharing your own journey. Right. For me, as the executive director and not the inaugural executive director of the Disability Screen Office, it's really important for me to share my story, what my experiences are. I also come from working within the 2S LGBTQI plus community, where it's very similar, you know, working in that community for 20 plus years, sharing my coming out story, my lived experiences, really encourage other folks to do the same. And even in my short time here at the DSO, just coming upon 2 years, the impact that it's had on folks on their own journey of divulging and realizing the many tearful emotional conversations I've had with folks, just realizing, or just for example, you know, many folks have said to me, you know, after this conversation, I've gone and changed my website. I've gone and changed my bio and put disabled into it. You know, people feel a little bit more encouraged to ask those questions during conferences and panels. I've seen it where there have been diversity panels, but they don't include accessibility. Very often, DEI, diversity, inclusion, and equity work, does not include accessibility. So even part of our work here at the DSO is about including that A, including that word, that labeling it, saying it out loud, which will invite folks to divulge, share, ask the questions, and hopefully make those requests right off the top. So again, everyone are aligned and we have the same expectations.
We see a lot of focus given also to visible disabilities, where you have, you know, the parking placards on the car, which is a person in a wheelchair. But how are you finding the conversations with folks when you're having these accessibility conversations, processing through invisible disabilities? Because we know so many disabilities are not a wheelchair, right?
Yeah, it doesn't help that that icon, right? The universal icon is a mobility, a person in a wheelchair, because you're right. There are so many different types of disabilities. And again, everyone experiences their own disability differently. And so in the sense of invisible disability, especially right now, even the word neurodivergent, that is such a new term and understanding that we're finding that there's this trend right now where mothers, parents, right? Fathers and mothers are diagnosing their children and the children want to be diagnosed. And very quickly are they saying, oh, I have these exact same characteristics. I've been masking my whole life. Like I didn't realize, I didn't understand that. It wasn't me. It's my environment, right? That this is how my brain works. You know, again, it's about setting up those expectations and really talking about it. I mean, I don't want to put the onus or responsibility on the person who's disabled to do this, right? It's about creating an environment where they feel safe to talk about it and divulge, and everyone is sharing their own journeys and stories. I mean, we're in the industry of storytelling. So how can you be authentic to yourself if you're not sharing the side of you? And what I'm also finding is, you know, across the industry, I think even before as the DSO was developing and coming to fruition and the folks really setting it up, there was almost a thought or misconception of here's the disability community here and here's the industry here. But what I'm finding that there's so much overlap, and I've had so many conversations now where industry leaders, so I'm talking about executive directors, CEOs, presidents of their own organization, and they've had decades of their career, but have never talked about their own disability. And or not understanding what disability means. I've had, these are real examples of someone saying to me, I'm blind in one eye, but I'm not disabled. I'm deaf in one ear, but I'm not disabled. I experience all this chronic pain, but I'm not disabled. Or I go through all this anxiety. I have depression, but I'm not disabled. So the invisible disabilities I'm finding right now in our current kind of environment are folks, because it's not in your face, it's easier to hide. It's easier not to talk about, And that in itself is a barrier, right? It's not easy to bring it up. And again, these are people with power, with influence, and they themselves feel the fear and the stigma because we're combating, we're talking about decades and centuries of othering and oppression and discrimination, right? Very similar with the other identities, whether it's a queer 2SLGBTQ identity or Black identity, racialized identity, Indigenous identity. There's so many identities that have been oppressed for so long. And disability right now, you know, being one of the newest organizations tackling this type of work, it's one of the last things on the horizon that's being tackled in this industry, right? There's so much already thought being put into like sustainability, right? Like so much thought even into putting, intimacy coordinators are a thing now. Sustainability coordinators are a thing now. We have amazing sister organizations, Indigenous and the Black Screen Office, doing incredible work. And so it's interesting. And when I was even applying for this role, I think I was shocked to find out that the Screen Office was new. That there wasn't a DSO for 10 plus years already doing this work. So even someone who've been working in activism and working in disability rights for so long, being someone who has lived experiences with disability, I think even for me, I was like, oh, wow, the resources, like so limited, the understanding, the awareness, education, so limited, especially to our sector.
You touched on something earlier on. You said universal design. Can you explain to people listening what that is?
It's really designing, whether it's a program or an event, with the idea of everyone that could be engaging or participating in it. When I say everyone, that plays into all the intersectionalities of someone's identity, all their possible disabilities that they might have, but it could also be a newcomer, right, where English is not their first language. And again, the overlap, even with some of the accommodation services, captioning, right, that doesn't just help people who are deaf. It literally helps people where English is not their first language, where they do not absorb or understand information as quickly through oral and audio. So seeing it represented, and we're a visual, right? We're a visual industry and sector. So to not have more visual or supports is actually quite interesting to me. And so when it comes to universal design, it is really putting a lens of bringing everyone along with us on this journey. And for us, it's particularly important in the disability community because we all learn and work at a different pace. And being truly inclusive is also considering the fact that maybe someone cannot work 8 hours straight, that they might need to take pauses, that this particular project might have to be shot over 2 4-hour shoots versus 1 8, 1 14, especially 18-hour long days, right? This is not, you know, when it comes to our sector, it's not a human or people first sector, right? It's a really profit driven sector. And I used to work in human rights, real life and death situations. And coming back to the sector where it's supposed to be entertainment and joyful and celebratory and innovative, it's actually very backwards in its design. And so when we're talking about universal design, it is really truly thinking about everyone in the sector. Everyone in the sector has value. We want to attract more labor, right? If we want to avoid a labor shortage, it is about making the work environment and the space and the ecosystem more welcoming for the many, many different types of people to be able to participate in it and, again, thrive, not just work in it and kind of hunker down and go through the motions and having to really stress their bodies out or their minds out. It's really about putting people first, human first, health first before work. You know, few benefits that came out of COVID is that people are now really thinking more about their own health and a balance of work life, right? People want more time. And people understand we can't take this for granted, right? We have one shot. And so why are we essentially dedicating anywhere between 40 to 80 to 100 hours a week and just kind of trudging along when, again, we're in this sector of Inspiration and storytelling, and we want it to be authentic storytelling and entertainment, and bring some light, right, to what is a very chaotic world right now, and to make it more compassionate and more of a human first and health first approach. For me, that is also part of universal design.
You know what I love about that is that, you know, we have designers, we've got costume designers, production designers, people who really create the worlds, and having that as a tool to actually deepen and make more rich their creations is just a beautiful sort of way to approach it from a creative perspective as well.
Absolutely. A trickle-down effect. I mean, it's proven in the sense that when people are happy, they're more productive, right? When people feel supported, they're more productive. So even if the bottom line is business for some people and, right, their pockets, all research leads to believe that if someone, and retention, right, retention saves money. You want a sustainable organization. You want folks to stay around. I mean, training and onboarding someone, that alone takes so much time and effort. Why would you want them to be unhappy and leave the project within just 6 months when you've already invested all this time and dedication? So in the sense of making sure you're providing an environment and opportunities for people to really, truly be authentic, bring their lived experience, whether it's career and professional experience, but their own personal lived experience to their work, again, especially in a sector of storytelling, why wouldn't we want to encourage that? Because right now, again, that structure, it's the opposite, right? 14, 18 hour days. How can you bring your best self when you're working those hours? And again, if you want to, and it's because you really want to bank those hours and take off a chunk of the year, great. But it's about freedom of choice. Not everyone can, and a lot of people cannot sustain those hours. It just physically is impossible. And again, when you're working 14, 18 hours, it's just not sustainable. Where are you sleeping? When are you spending time with loved ones? Where are you finding more inspiration for your storytelling, right? To be your authentic self. And so if we're wanting all of these things out of our workers, you know, our colleagues, I would say at the same time, support them so they can live a life where they, you know, they're finding, I want to say inspirational, but something that they want to be committed to, passionate about. I look for in my jobs and careers and in the communities I work in, things that really touch me, right? Touch my heart, that I can share my own lived experiences and knowledge and skills in. And I imagine they're looking for, they're spending, you know, 40 plus hours of their week that they're wanting to do something that brings them some type of satisfaction. I think that really is not just about, you know, clocking and clocking out, but in, again, our sector specifically, it is about creating something, a story, a visual, like piece of art, narrative, where they want to either share their message or inspire or bring a story or focus or topic to light, you know, share information. But we're in the business of, again, entertainment and information and storytelling. So why wouldn't you want to support those very people creating these stories and creating these art pieces, creating the cinema, creating the TV series? It just doesn't make sense to me to make it hard for people working in the sector to create, whether it's like fantasies or documentaries, scripted, unscripted, kids, you know, the kids space especially. I'm seeing a lot of activity and engagement right now, especially in the kids space. And I think it's an amazing thing because this type of education and this type of authentic representation, I think it's important to expose people at a young age because many children who have disabilities or who have different ways of experiencing the world, I think there's so much hardship in growing up right now with social media and bullying, etc. Everyone wants to find community. Everyone wants to feel less isolated. And I think a lot of people look to cinema and TV. I know I did growing up, struggling with my own queer identity. I was desperate to find any representation. I remember scouring the Blockbuster aisles, right, looking for any video that would maybe have a queer character on it. And it's about understanding and knowing that you're not the only one going through this. And so a lot of people, I think, look to the screen industry for that. we do have a responsibility, right, to then actually create and develop authentic stories so people, again, don't feel as isolated and alone and know that there are others going through this. Because disability, I mean, of all the identities, everyone at one point in their lives will become disabled, right? By the nature of aging or by accident. A lot of my mobility issues came about when I had various accidents because I was a very active child. I was doing a lot of sports and the wear and tear on my joints. You know, I had a near fatal accident where I severed my artery and nerve when I was young and my ankle, so I had permanent nerve damage. And it's cyclical. Once I screw up my knee, then of course my back, like it's just, you know, my back is hurting and then it's my knee. And so it's, you know, it's a cyclical thing. I'm also on my own journey of being diagnosed as neurodivergent. I'm a self-diagnosed. I've always known this about myself. I mean, that's essentially how I'm able to do some of the work I do. I can do a lot of things at one time. If anything, I thrive in an environment where I can do 101 things at one time. And so for me, it's important to go through this journey and share this journey with others as well. It is really, for me, a core piece of how I, you know, build relationships, build trust, and build community, essentially, is sharing my own experiences. When I was young and gay, if I had anyone sharing those experiences with me, if I knew what resources were out there in the world, I think I would have had a very different youth. I had a great youth, but there was always a part of me that felt it was really, really hard and isolating.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the storytelling aspect you talked about is so critical because also there are so many stories, and we've talked a bit on this podcast about reconciliation, equity, diversity, inclusion, the stories that have been missing from our media, from our streaming, from our movies. And there was a really great interview I saw with Daniel Levy that talked about how Schitt's Creek was one of the breakthrough ones that told stories that hadn't been told without a trauma underpinning. The queer storylines were just part of their story. It was their identity. It was their authenticity. I would love you to get to give me examples that prove where I'm wrong, but I feel like we don't see a lot of that for accessibility stories yet. Like the underpinning of trauma is still the storytelling device that makes it okay for someone to appear different on screen. How do you experience that in terms of the media that you're seeing right now?
What we're trying to get away from is these quote unquote inspirational stories, right? Mm-hmm. From the community. And it only is, you know, triggered by some trauma that they might have experienced or accident, and they're now, you know, thriving in spite of it, etc. I mean, again, with disability, it's actually more common than you think. Why is it not then just part of a story, right? And you're very right in LGBTQ to his representation for the longest time. Lesbians were villainized, right? Someone had to die. It was like these stories over and over again. I remember at one point thinking like, oh my gosh, is this what it means to be queer in this world, right? How hard, how difficult. And finally, you know, watching certain films where I'm like, oh gosh, thank goodness, they actually survived. They're thriving. They're okay. They got away with it. Whatever it is, I'm thinking in my mind right now, Bound, because that was a film that I watched when I was very young that really spoke to me because, one, it was a beautifully shot film, beautiful told film, but the characters were so strong. The lesbians within the storyline, you know, they were the ones who were plotting and scheming. I don't want to, spoiler alert, I don't want to actually spoil the ending, but essentially at that time, it was one of the few stories where I'm like, oh, okay, it doesn't just end in a tragedy or, you know, the lesbian isn't being punished. In the sense of disability representation, a lot of it, again, it is very much, they have to be almost superhuman, right? And again, disability, it really should be just part of the storytelling, right? I think it's more about options. I'm not saying there shouldn't be these other stories where maybe it does inspire people. Great, that's wonderful. But I think we need to have more diversity within these stories because there's just such a large, massive range of experiences within disability. So whether it is just literally even having people with disabilities in the background shot, right? Or whether it's the main character or the supporting character, I think it's really about fully representing the very large range and spectrum of any identity, not just disability, right? I can align it with to SLGBT identity, with folks who are racialized, all of it, but it is, there's not just one story and one dimension. People are multi-dimension, and folks who are lucky enough to live a long life, they have so many different experiences. And I think it's the responsibility of, again, storytellers to not over and over again tell the same story. And I think audiences, we're maturing, right? What we want as audiences are changing. It's a totally new generation. And so when folks see something inauthentic on screen, people rip it to shreds, right? The reviews. So you just put in millions of dollars, you've invested millions of dollars, and you haven't engaged the right communities or the right folks to help or the right consultants to help you with developing the story or character. And when it hits the screen, people can tell this is not real. This is not authentic. Why not be more proactive in it at the very beginning? If you want to tell a story about someone with a disability, engage someone with a disability and make sure it's not just anyone with a disability. It's, again, everybody's experiences are different. What we see with a lot of disabled creatives is that they have to always wear these two hats, right? They have a disability, they work on set, and maybe whether they are, you know, a camera operator or what have you, but they always have to also become, by default, the disability expert, right? And that happens time and time again. And there's a program that we're actually launching very shortly, which is creating and developing a production accessibility role. We're going to create the job description, the curriculum. We're going to train a pilot cohort. But right now, the production accessibility role exists as a coordinator in the States, and there's a handful of folks that also work in Canada. But what we want to do with this role is elevate it so it has more decision-making power, it has more influence, and it's inserted right at the beginning of a project. And so that way they can actually say, oh, budget line, here it is, right? Locations, this is inaccessible, we have to move it. Oh, this shoot day, 18 hours, no, this does not work. So someone inserted at the very beginning who has that responsibility to train the team to be the person where folks can then also go to and divulge their access needs or their disability and feel safe and good and create this environment on set to make sure that, again, accessibility is thought about at the very, very beginning and not this afterthought. Because what we're finding with consultants and coordinators, they're brought on at the end and there's nothing you can do. What can you do when there's no budget actually aligned with accessibility except for to hire this person? And again, we also know that people don't have to listen to coordinators and consultants. They can hire them and they might have checked some box for a funding application, but did they actually follow through with the work and the activities or the initiatives that these consultants and coordinators are asked upon them? And we're working with unions, labor organizations, and other associations, and essentially industry at large, making sure that there's buy-in for this role, right? We want people to understand the importance and what the purpose of this role is, and making sure it works within the existing ecosystem, and having these conversations and collaborating and partnering with folks to create this job description.
Sounds like these coordinators need union representation.
Yes.
I know a place. We also represent First Aid Craft Service, right, and their health and safety on set. So if you would like to continue that conversation, I'm happy to have that with you. I want to move a little bit to growing up. You know, I'm a Gen Xer, so, you know, very limited amount of disability represented on anything I ever saw on screen. And really, the only thing I can think of is when Drake played his character in Degrassi, right? And how stereotypical is that? I mean, we talked about the symbol being the wheelchair for representing accessibility. And so do some myth busting with us. What are some commonly held beliefs that are just completely and totally false that you feel folks with disabilities have to battle all the time?
Oh, gosh. It is the stereotypes. Some of these stereotypes are very harmful, and also just the narrow views, as you said. It doesn't help that the disability symbol is a person in a wheelchair, because that is only one form of disability. And even everyone who's a wheelchair user, they experience that they have their own individual experiences. And so it is so important to understand that, you know, Whether you have physical disability or it's intellectual disability or you're neurodivergent, you're going to go through life experiencing, whether it is the school system, whether it's careers, you're going to have your individual experiences, and you cannot just pigeonhole, right? All the people who are a wheelchair user, all the people who are deaf, all the people who are blind, even when there's a misconception of everyone who's deaf need ASL interpretation. There are folks who read lips only and do not need ASL interpretation. So statistically, Canadian population, 27% of the population have a disability. But this is, you know, counted by the Canadian census. It increased from the last census, which read 22%. But anecdotally, as I meet people across the country, I do ask this various questions. Do you check that box, right, when the census comes around? And most often, people are saying no, because there is this misconception that if they check a box anytime, so not just the census, but even for a conference registration, an event registration, or festival registration, that they're actually, they think they're taking something away from someone else. I was really intrigued by that notion. And instead of, we all know a Canadian census is about collecting data, right? Collecting data and information. And that is so important, because if you're not counted or understand the population, how then do you start even creating resources and programs and tools to support this population when you have an inaccurate count? And so when it comes to 27%, it's already the largest underrepresented population of Canadian society. But I know for a fact that it is greatly undercounted, 27%. I think it's actually barely even scratching the surface, because there is an aging population. Again, anecdotally, when I talk to folks, most folks say their parents who do, again, losing their vision, losing their hearing, using mobility devices, more often than not, those folks are not checking that box either. Again, it's this misconception of what does it mean when I checked the disability box? So when it lends to the actual count of 27%, I feel like if there is more awareness, more understanding of what disability actually means and how much it encapsulates, that that will easily rise to 30-something, 40-something percent. And then within our sector itself, I think it draws actually folks who are neurodivergent, because a lot of folks who work in this industry, they're working in this industry because they do not align or want to work in the corporate 9-to-5. They want to really engage and kind of use their creativity, their innovation. They don't want to be just be put in a box or put in a pigeonhole. They really want to work for a sector that promises all these things, right? Being able to, again, be creative and be innovative. And so when they come into that, I think it's a little bit of a rude awakening for a lot of folks, what the industry actually offers versus what it kind of promises. And so the misconceptions of also, again, you know, if you have a disability, you cannot do as much or offer as much, which I see such the opposite, right? Again, if I was to speak to my own personal experience, you know, I've always leaned into understanding that I might be neurodivergent, because this is why I can take the roles I've taken throughout my careers, building organizations, wearing all the different hats at one time. Sometimes I'm doing one email, but I can't finish that email. I literally have to go to another task. But the thing is, I have 101 tasks to go to. So I jump from project to project to, you know, task to task. And that's how I know I need to work, right? You know, in the sense of just how I organize myself, what I really lean into. I know what my my skill set is, and that lends itself to my own understanding of my own neurodivergence. And so in the sense of misconceptions, a lot of folks think, you know, if you are autistic or if you are you have ADHD, there's this one one identity that people always think about, white cis men, right, that are diagnosed. And a lot of the stories and the representation are usually cis white men having all these experiences. A lot of the supports and programs support this one profile. But again, so many different profiles of folks who can have autism or be neurodivergent, and how it presents itself, especially in women, can differ, but we only know and see this one representation of it. And again, the healthcare system, whatever supports that it have, are usually geared towards this one profile. And so that is another, you know, misconception that we want to bust up. It's really about these stereotypes. Stereotypes are stereotypes, and they can be harmful because it's, again, it's like this one dimension of seeing this one experience or this one profile. And again, we are so different as humans, right? Whether it's geography, whether it's language, whether it's, again, disability or non-disability, we have so many different experiences. So to, again, just really concentrating on just one aspect of anything will be harmful, not just in the disability community.
You have a gift for talking about this in a way that is so disarming and builds safety in the way that you share your story. Like, I feel so seen in my own lived experience, and also like permission to really think through and like think about that box on those forms, right? And like, why haven't I checked them in the past? And realizing that, like with some other intersectionalities, there's an internalized anti-disability way that we were trained that we're othering ourselves, and we're so afraid because we've always been othered, right? I mean, it's nice and altruistic to think, oh, I'm not checking it because I'm taking away from someone else. But the reality of that internalized discrimination of, oh, I don't want to check that box, I don't want to be like that.
Exactly. And I think it's, again, it's just so human of us, all of us, to want to feel like we're part of something, right? Part of a community, finding others with similar experiences. And I think that is the one thoroughfare in our population, is we'll all experience disability at one point in our lives. So why not share that, right? To make other folks feel less isolated, less alone in the world. We're human beings. We want to interact with one another. And our industry, our society is right now, has been structured to favor a particular demographic of people. And that shouldn't be the case, because they really reside in such a small percentage of our population. And like I said, 27%, I think, is barely scratching the surface of how many folks are actually disabled. And what a better place to live, to understand that there are other people feeling and experiencing the same things. For me, you know, you can't start any work or progress, anything, without building trust, building relationships. We cannot do this on our own, especially as the DSO. We are new. We're one of the newest organizations. And it was only me until last July, right? So I was doing it by myself with an amazing board of directors that were operational, but for just a little over a year. And so I had to really make sure, for the sustainability of our organization, make sure that we partner and collaborate with other folks, with our community, with the disability community, engaging them, making sure that we're working. And we do. We work with every organization across the sector, because in the sense of when I talk about bringing everyone along with us, I cannot just work with the producers. I cannot just work with broadcasters. I have to work with Canadian Heritage, the CRTC, the broadcasters, the funders, all the unions, labor organizations, and associations, along with festivals, events, and conferences, and markets, and the distributors. So it's really about working together and doing this in a more methodical, thoughtful, paced out way, where we are truly bringing everyone along with us. Because if I just concentrate on little pockets of the industry, it's going to be overwhelming, and it's going to put a lot of stress on these areas or on these parts of the industry. And that, again, our work is about putting less stress. It's about really working together thoughtfully and really meaningfully starting this work so it's sustainable. And that's not intimidating or overwhelming. Because I think what ends up happening a lot of the time as well, and even within my first year, a lot of folks, when they were meeting me for the first time, they right away, it's like, is it okay if I say this, right? What about this? Or what about this? even the terminology, right? People don't understand the terminology, and there's a lot of fear around what they can or cannot say. And the role of the DSO and how I see myself as leading this organization as executive director is making sure that people feel good and safe to ask all the questions, because I'd rather you ask me than the disabled crane operator, right? Like, that's the thing, is that their job is to do this. My job is to help and support and build these programs and make it good and easy and safe for you to ask whatever questions you need to ask.
Tell us, Winnie, then, being such a new organization, how are you funded? How do you run? How are you structured?
So we work with some incredible industry organizations. So in the sense of funding, our very early on, Telefilm and CMF jumped in right away. So this is even before my time. So the DSO was incubated through Accessible Media Inc. In early 2022, and it only became autonomous in September of 2022. And I came on in June of 2023, and there was an interim executive director, Andrew Morris, who did a fantastic job in one recruiting our board of directors. And they also were able to find the kind of seed funding, which was CMF and Telefilm. And CMF funded the first phase, essentially, of our research project. And so we're now currently in our phase two, but phase one really helped kind of inform the direction of the DSO, what the priorities were, what the kind of landscape was in the sector, what was needed, where the gaps were. And it was AMI who saw that gap, right, in the industry, that there were no programs or organizations that was specifically dedicated to disability. And so we are the only organization of its kind doing this type of work in all of the Canadian screen industry. And since I've come on, the relationships I build, common question I get actually is, I think people just assume that I might get pushback in this work, but I haven't, to be perfectly honest. The rallying, the support, I think people have just been waiting for the DSO to open up, because so many people had these questions they wanted to ask. My very full inbox and our info inbox, right? It was hard to keep up, because the moment I started, the inquiries, the requests, whether for partnerships and collaborations, I had to really be methodical in pacing out our work and being careful who we collaborate, because it was just me and our capacity. I want to make sure that this is sustainable work and that it's not just one and done, right? That we are only truly at the very beginning of moving the needle forward in this work, in this industry. And so in the sense of, you know, meeting Hillary, gosh, I think my first time over out there in Vancouver, I at Z-Local 891 jumped right in, right? The WGC jumped right in to help, right? We have our funders and supporters, but in the sense of Ontario Creates, Creative BC, these organizations and all the other equity deserving organizations I also work closely with, whether it's the Black Screen Office, Indigenous Screen Office, CISF, BIPOC Film and TV, the list goes on. Everyone has just rallied and supported our work. And so I was able to grow the organization quite quickly within my first year to the second year. And even this year, we're very lucky with, you know, we just approved our next operational budget. And we have, you know, five programs up and running, and we are more than 10 times, you know, larger than when I had started. So it's very obvious that the need and the desire and the want is here in the sector. And that, again, if anything, I've had to really make sure to pace out all the opportunities that are coming our way to make sure that we are working with the right people at this time. And so in the sense of funding, yeah, we've been very, very lucky with the folks we've been able to work with. Because we work in employment and human rights, we are also eligible for other types of funding that other equity deserving organizations in the sector might not be eligible for. So we have Accessibility Standards Canada funding for our massive research project. They're funding a three-year research project that will culminate into a report that we'll be submitting to them at the end of it. And then also employment, ESDC, so Employment Services Development, they are funding our operations and capacity building, funding that other equity deserving organizations, we know that there is this unfortunate cycle of it's always about funding programs, and then we're taking that small 15% admin fee to build an organization, which is a bit backwards. It really should be about building the infrastructure of an organization, its operations and its capacity, right? Strategic planning, staffing, governance, to build a solid foundation, then to roll out programs on. And so we were lucky enough to also receive ESDC funding to help with our governance building, our strategic planning, our operations building, and human resources. So that has helped us significantly as well to grow the organization quite quickly.
So one of the projects that you have had going on this year was the first ever screen industry survey on disability. Can you speak a little bit to the role that that plays in your ongoing research project and how that will inform what's coming next for the DSO?
That survey is so important. I know there's so many surveys that are out there. I understand that survey fatigue is a real thing. At that time, I was saying, if it was one survey you're going to take, this is the survey you need to take. Because again, it's the first ever of its kind, right, in the Canadian screen sector. And it's really an understanding, whether you're disabled or not. When we were outreaching for it, I said, everyone in this sector should be taking the survey. It's not just for folks who identify with a disability, because we need to have a real understanding of who is working in this industry, who wanted to work in this industry and then had to leave because of ableism, and the various barriers that people are experiencing. And this is only a small part. We're also doing focus groups, as well as there were literature reviews, et cetera. But the survey is really about collecting that data that we just do not have right now as a sector. And, you know, data is important to, you know, to the funders, right? It's important to understand, again, the ecosystem in which we are working and playing, to understand what supports are needed. And in that phase one of that research project, where there were focus groups and surveys as well, or serving the community in the sense of what was needed, there were huge gaps. It was essentially awareness of accessibility and disability. It's so much more important to engage and work with and hire disabled folks versus just consulting with them, right? It really should be folded right into your own work culture and environment. And most often than not, you are probably working with colleagues with disabilities, but you just don't know. And even again, in the last, the short amount of time, I've witnessed and observed people's own journey in coming out and sharing with me their divulging of their disability. And so in the sense of the survey, it is, you know, not only the data that it's collecting, but I think even the sheer existence of the survey, you know, Canadian Screen Industry Survey on Disability, it gives people permission to talk about it, to share it, to demystify again. It's really about encouraging folks to talk about it, to be counted, to share their own experiences with barriers, or sharing observations. So if you're an ally and you don't have a disability, sharing observations of what you might have witnessed some of your colleagues have experienced, or what you have witnessed yourself in the sense of ableism in this industry. And so, yeah, that data will really, really help us forward our work, and we can, you know, actually refer to it. Because a lot of the information right now is anecdotal. I've spent a lot of time traveling across country, talking to disabled creatives, talking to, you know, the various industry organizations and industry leaders and their experiences, what they're trying to do in their own organizations, some of the barriers they have faced, some of the pushback or why they haven't started this work, or just the sheer understanding, right? Like, that's the thing, is that most people, another program that we have launched, it will be a series of 4 short videos training the industry on legislation. So many people don't even understand that we have federal legislation and provincial legislation. And so we're going to create 4 short videos where at the end of each video, you'll take a quick quiz. And by the end of the 4 video series, you'll also be certified with understanding. Because even when we were presenting at our first CRTC hearing, I think it was the fall of 2023, when we had submitted our intervention letter and also talked about it. This was the CRTC hearing on the Online Streaming Act. So many folks came to us afterwards, and some were funders, We didn't know about the legislation, right? So it is very common that folks are, you know, whether they are conducting their work, conducting their organizations, not understanding that there's actually legislation in regards to accessibility. And the Canadian, you know, Accessibility Canada Act was actually enacted in 2019 with a deadline of 2040 for a fully accessible Canada. Again, most people do not understand that. So this training series is hopefully going to educate folks on what they should be accountable to.
What I'd love to know is, where do you see the Disability Screen Office in the next 5 years? What's the trajectory? What would you like to see?
A full industry buy-in, right? We're just beginning this work in the sense that we're building the resources. There was very little resources. You know, we're also creating a resource hub. It was important to us because another very common question or request we get from the public is, do you know this accommodation service provider? Like, where can we find this? Where can we find this? And essentially what we want to do is create a resource hub where it's a one-stop shop for all the information. So we are going out and doing the research and collecting all the tools and resources that are currently out there and reports internationally and the few that there might exist in Canada. Another part of this resource hub for me is about really crediting and spotlighting other folks, other organizations having done this work before us and making sure that what work they've created or what resources they've created is actually discoverable. Because a lot of the times what we have found is that any type of resource is just like people scrolling through links and links and links, and it's unwielding and it's hard to access. And then people just kind of give up. So what we want to do is create a place, a hub on our website where everyone knows to come here, and then they could find the accommodation service providers, an accessible venue, accessibility consultant, essentially any reports. We're going to also develop a terminology, a list as well, because again, a lot of folks don't know that you can say disabled. Some people think that that's a bad word, but in fact, that is what we prefer. We also have a program for screen festival accessibility. And so, you know, in my first year, I was traveling coast to coast to coast. And when I was meeting with disabled creatives, they themselves were not able to access or not attending the very festivals I was attending because it wasn't accessible to them. I have a festival background. And so for me, I'm like, we need to do something about this right away. We already had other projects on the go and in development, but for me, festivals, conferences, these are the hubs where people, whether you're emerging, intermediate, or established in your career, these are the hubs where you go to network, to build relationships, to pitch your ideas, to find, again, your partnerships, win awards, educate, training, panels, etc. And so it was really important for me to make sure that these spaces were actually accessible. And so we have now a program where we're working with four festivals. That's the Vancouver International, the Banff World Media Festival, Real Asian and Real World here in Toronto. We're going to use them as case studies and developing a best practices guide and standards for festivals across the country and making their festivals more accessible. And we're also creating a framework for funders, telethon specifically in this case, on what they should be looking for and applications and projects that come to them and making sure that they are also prioritizing accessibility. And so I've talked about all these five programs. So in the next 5 years, use these resources because, you know, some of them, they're taking us multiple years to develop and create and launch because this takes time. We do have to understand our ecosystem, right? The data collection, the research, the focus groups, the surveys, making sure we actually understand the climate in which we are working with, who we're working with, the barriers that people are facing, and then create and develop the resources to tackle these barriers and essentially support, again, disabled creatives to thrive in this industry. So adoption of our resources, starting your own. I'm hoping that other organizations will start their own disability action plans, accessibility action plans, and strategic planning. You know, in our first year, in our second year, even in our third, I understand you might be in the midst of your current strategic plan, but there is no excuse while you're planning your next strategic plan that accessibility isn't a key pillar in that, right? We should all be starting this work. And again, I am going to be patient because this is new, right? This is new information. I don't want people to feel overwhelmed or stressed. It's really about doing and starting this work in a particular pace and being very thoughtful in it and bringing everyone along with us. And so in the first 3 years, start understanding, start learning, reaching out to us. And then within the 4 or 5, you need to start adopting these practices, right? Start creating your own action plans, putting into your strategic plan, because in 5 years' time, there are going to be more resources. There's going to be more education, more training, more toolkits out in the world for you to be using. And so in 5 years' time, I hope that there's even more rallying support for the DSO in this work, but that you're also starting this work in your own organization and being leaders in your own organization and role modeling for the entire industry. When I was first traveling and starting the Screen Festival Accessibility Program, at first I was going to pick the top 5 film festivals in Canada and approach them to start this 3-year program in developing this accessibility plan, because I hold larger festivals more accountable. They have more resources, more capacity, and I think they should be responsible in modeling this work. And to be honest, medium to smaller festivals have started this work already with less resources. It's really about prioritizing, right? That for me, it's like the number one thing is about prioritizing this work. So in 5 years' time, I hope more and more people are prioritizing this work and working with us to make a really, truly more accessible and inclusive Canadian screen sector.
I want to take it back to a word you said several times. It's a thoughtful approach with real intention behind it for change and inclusivity, whole person, holistic. And these are all approaches that we can all adopt throughout our work and our lives. I just really want to thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me and hosting me and having these conversations and being one of our first supporters, right? Like, I will always remember the organizations that literally, it was like, they came on, no question, to support this work because they understood, right? I didn't need to convince them that this work is important, right? I'm not about convincing people. It's really about mutual understanding and collaboration and us working together organically and building this work together to make real change and sustainable change. Because I think the last thing we would want is to roll out all these resources and say that you have to do this, make everything mandatory. No one wants to work in an environment like that. Essentially, that's what the current environment really is. And we are pushing against that structure. We're pushing against this industry that has not in history been putting people first and health first, and understanding that, again, every person, they have their individual lived experience, whether it's with a disability or not. But I think when you start working and understanding disability and building your accessibility plans, that it's going to include everyone, again, not just people who are disabled. And so doing it, as you said, in this holistic nature, really including every part of the sector is so important to us, because we cannot just concentrate on one aspect alone. It will just become too much stress on one part of the industry. And really what we're trying to do is alleviate all this ownership and accountability on one person. It's really about everyone doing this work, everyone understanding this work. And even when we're creating this role, this production accessibility role, the goal of it is that the knowledge and accessibility information is not just in their head, that they will be training their colleagues. And the trickle-down effect, when you're training other folks, we're hoping that those folks then will help and share that information, and it will just go on and on and on. And I prefer to work in more of a horizontal approach, like working side by side, right? But our industry, there is a hierarchy. And so if there's a hierarchy, I'm going to also hold folks in decision-making power, these gatekeepers, more accountable in starting this work, funding this work, supporting this work. And again, very early on, there has been no pushback. People have really been rallying and supporting our programs and investing in us, right? So not just saying it, but really investing in our organization, in our program. And we've been able to grow quite quickly and significantly.
I've loved getting to know you more. It's been so good to have you here today with us. Thank you for all of your time. And I'm personally going to really remember how important it is to check those boxes. So thank you.
Thanks, Hilary. Thanks, Crystal.
Thanks, Winnie.
Pleasure.
Bye.
Apple Box Talks is an IATSE 891 production and is recorded on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples. The podcast is hosted by business representative Crystal Bronworth and assistant business representative Hillary Bergshaw, and produced by Quentin Benetti. For more episodes, check out ourwork.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Apple Box.